It was hugely successful. It was more successful than any other issue we published in Waitrose that year. And it showed us that actually if we create a great product, then the market is there. People will buy it, even in today's world where, you know, print is under so much pressure.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to this week's episode of Media Voices, the media focused podcast that brings you all the news and the views from around the media world. I'm Chris Sutcliffe.
I'm Esther Thorpe.
And I'm Peter Houston.
And that quote you just heard is from Paul Newman, who is the brand director of Home Interest at Future PLC. So we had a chat about how home titles have evolved in the age of platforms like Pinterest, how they've actually managed to increase print circulation revenue, and what they're doing to reach younger audiences across multiple platforms.
First of all, though, we're going to go through our news roundup. And to begin with, The Information and Bloomberg have come together to trial a year-long joint subscription. Now, this is effectively just a clever promotion, but maybe the first of its kind in the industry?
Yeah. I think Ben Thompson from Stratechery pointed out it's not actually a bundle. Lots of people are saying, oh, it's a news bundle. And I think because it renews separately at the end of the year, it is literally just like a year-long promotion.
I think that's quite a clever way of going about it, particularly if you have, at least in theory, these two products both overlap.
Well, I think Jessica Lesson actually said on Twitter when Thompson asked her about it, she said that it was it's because of the whole where the back end works on subscribes. It's actually quite complicated. So they're like, we're just going to test this for a little bit so that we can move fast and learn. And then they'll figure out what a renewal looks like at some point in the future.
So how is this breaking down price-wise? Because they're both not inexpensive products.
Yeah, that's one way of putting it.
Yeah.
So if you were to just get an annual subscription to Bloomberg, I want to say set you back. That would rightly cost you $475. That could go up to $749 if you want to get an annual subscription to The Information. But the combined subscription bundle trial promotion thingy that they're doing is $499. So it's saving you probably $300 to $400. And in with that, you get access to all of the exclusive subscriber newsletters, video calls, apps, podcasts, and all the paywall reporting across both sites. So it's quite a good deal.
I'm conflicted.
Okay, go on. Why?
Well, when we've talked about The Information before, it was one of those products that was just like, oh yeah, this is how paid content works. This is how reader revenue works. You've got very focused stuff and it's got a decent price point and they did special deals for people at certain stages in their career and it just all seemed really well thought through. And this is like, oh, shit, man. I know, let's do a deal with Bloomberg.
All right, okay.
I don't know, just...
Do you think it's devaluing the value of a subscription to The Information alone?
So here's really what I'm thinking.
All right, okay.
So is it a scale play? Is it a big scale?
So Digiday had a piece about, and it had some quite detailed breakdown about their traffic. And basically The Information is doing really, really well on conversion because it's paywalled, like everything, literally everything is paywalled, whereas Bloomberg's still got a bit of a metered model at the moment. But Bloomberg's got like an insane number of times the traffic that The Information does. But then The Information is much more niche and much more focused than Bloomberg. So it's a part of me wondered if this was just a quick way for them to scale a little bit.
Yeah, maybe.
I mean, and that's no bad thing, really, is it?
Yeah, because how long have we talked about scale being a bad thing?
All right, but there's scale and then there's scale, if you know what I mean. This isn't indiscriminate. This is going after an audience that they know, that Jessica Lesson knows is likely to convert. And they get something like north of 80%, according to Digiday article, of their revenue is from individual subscribers.
I suppose the thing about devaluing, though, is that for Bloomberg, so the revenue from this $499 is going to be split 50-50 for this first year, even if, like, you know, the Bloomberg brings in 10 times more subscribers, they still split that revenue equally. But for Bloomberg, that's fine. They get basically like a half-price subscriber. But from $749 to $250, it's quite a drop for The Information.
Do you do deals like that if everything's good?
One thing I was thinking about this is, you know, there was that big, there was the Reuters news report last year that said that even like news fanatics only tend to have one subscription.
Yeah.
I think this is a real play for that. And it's right, if you're going to get one subscription, we're not going to fight with Bloomberg for it. we're going to join forces because $250 is better than nothing.
But to me, the information was coming in the same sort of space, but very, very focused on technology.
Mm.
So, yeah, I can see where there's a bundle. Do you know what? The only place I can see this going is Bloomberg buying the information.
You heard it here first.
Seriously.
I mean, I suppose, is this something we could see other publishers doing?
Yes. I'm not saying that this isn't a clever move, but it's a clever move in an industry that's not doing so good.
But you need that audience crossover, don't you? So you've got to have a kind of parity. I think you've got to have parity in terms of price point, or at least relative parity, and a significant audience crossover.
Okay, but what if you got a bundle that gave you sport, music, travel, and general news?
What, like the one Apple's offering or considering offering? I think this is possibly an early move to get ahead of that. Because, I mean, this ultimately is the sort of thing that you're likely to get your business to pay for. This is, I mean, it is a consumer subscription, but this is the sort of thing you could expense if you need this for your job. I wasn't convinced until I read Lesson's piece on it, because she wrote a really good piece on it, on the information about sort of the thought process behind it. Because they've been planning this since about September last year. And it was all about, publishers are getting really excited about this stuff Google and Facebook are offering with paying for articles and news products. And she's like, but it's where that power is again. And it's what this is doing is taking that power from the platforms, in theory. And it's just, it's a little bit like the cookie alliances and things. It's publishers coming together to present a stronger offering than what Google and Facebook can do.
For a year.
For a year, until both of us renew at various rates.
Yeah.
The back end of this, the way that they're doing it at the moment is if you buy a subscription on the information, you have to kind of complete it on Bloomberg's site, which is a little bit uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And when you then complete it, it says that Bloomberg's version will renew at the yearly $400 rate until after the first year is up. No refunds.
That would put me off. I know how bad I am at canceling one subscription after the free trial. So all of a sudden, I've got two.
I don't know. This something doesn't feel right about this.
Sticks in your craw.
Hmm.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
All right. Well, I've got an idea here.
Okay.
Okay, Google. Set a reminder for 1 year.
But first, you'll have to unlock your phone.
Oh, okay. Unlock your phone, Chris, for Christmas.
All right. Okay. And moving on, Esther, you were just talking about the power imbalance with platforms there. And the EU have rejected proposals from Facebook for standards and said that Facebook must adapt to the EU and not the other way around.
Nick Clegg isn't working.
So, isn't that what caused Brexit?
Oh, God. So the EU Industry Commissioner Thierry Breton has said that Facebook must adapt to Europe's standards and not the other way around in relation to Facebook's proposed internet rules, saying it is not for us to adapt to this company, it's for this company to adapt to us.
Can we have a media voices round of applause?
I was going to say, yeah.
I think he said something more along the lines of, it is not for us to adapt to this company, it is for this company to adapt to us.
Yeah. So he's due to present the first of this raft of rules to rein in US tech giants and quote unquote state-aided Chinese companies.
I can't actually believe I'm going to agree with Facebook here on Mark Zuckerberg. But his comeback was kind of, or certainly someone's comeback, was that these kind of government regulations ignore the nature of the internet.
Yeah.
And they do.
Absolutely, they do, yeah.
I just think they've found a really, really convenient scapegoat in Mark Zuckerberg as a human being, but also Facebook and Google and Amazon as corporate entities. And they can go, well, we've asked them to fix it, but the bastards aren't doing it.
So what rules specifically are they talking about here?
Facebook's proposals were pretty broad-ranging, weren't they? It was more like, we'll keep an eye on stuff. And we'll tell you every so often how it's going. And thanks very much. See you later, guys.
I think Breton said that Facebook had omitted any mention of its market dominance and failed to spell out its responsibilities, which made me chuckle.
Well, I mean, it's
Facebook wants regulation, but it wants regulation on its terms.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, but so my thing on this is that it is actually good that Facebook are trying to engage with this. And this is going to be a bit of a negotiation. You know, Facebook have got to come to the table, but the EU have also got to kind of work with it. Because like Peter, like you said, the EU don't understand it. Facebook do, but have incredibly nefarious motives.
Yeah, you need compromise on both sides. But the genie's out the bottle on this one. How we fix the internet? How do we... How the internet gets fixed, I don't think, is about laws or company regulation. It's about human beings getting a clue.
But, I mean, this is, if you don't engage the tech giants that are the problem, or most of the problem in a lot of this, you end up with situations like in France and Spain where France brings a rule in, Google are like, well, we don't agree with that, and you can't enforce it. So, you know, two fingers up, we're not doing it.
Yeah, I said a second ago that regulation and company self-regulation isn't the way to go with this. Of course it is. It's the only way to go with this. My point really is human beings have to change the way they are. They need to be kind. They need to stop being assholes.
I don't understand. That's not going to happen. That's not going to happen.
No, I realize the naivety of that statement.
People are going to get worse.
Really?
No, probably about the same.
Well, that's a depressing end of a story, that one.
Yeah. Okay. And on that cheery note, we're moving on to the news in brief. And as part of its goal to reach 2 million international subscriptions, the New York Times is adding a breaking news team in London. So I saw a very positive response to this. And on the face of it, it's a really good idea, considering that for a certain section of the day, the NYT is effectively run from London anyway.
So... My thing with this, because you know, I read quite a bit of the media coverage on the New York Times. Their publishing stuff is excellent. But I would never subscribe because it's New York, and it doesn't matter how much kind of UK focus they try and shoehorn into that. They are the New York Times. That is like their whole brand. And I don't think I'd ever trust that they would actually cover UK stuff properly.
Well, you can't just read the New York Times, but it gives you a different perspective than what you would read here.
Mm.
It's a global perspective, isn't it? We keep going back to this point, but because it's right, that Chris Duncan made ages ago about there being 10 world news brands.
Yeah.
It's exactly what this is about.
Esther, would it help if you knew and recognised some of the names of the journalists who were doing that coverage and you knew that they were based in London?
Interesting.
Ooh, maybe.
Also, would it help if you weren't in London? Because the rest of us in the provinces think, holy shit, could we be any more London-centric in this country? I may as well actually be New York-centric.
Well, you know, if you get the right tailwinds, if there's a storm going, you can be there in 4.5 hours.
Mm. And Twitter is experimenting with adding brightly coloured labels directly beneath, I quote, lies and misinformation posted by politicians and other public figures.
So
when I read this, I literally just had a vision of, you know, BuzzFeed's like, lol, fake news, nope. Like little stickers appearing under stuff.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that please.
I think they'd be better going with emojis, like the shrug emoji, the poo emoji.
Poop for tweets.
Yeah. Spain's government has approved a digital services tax, putting it on a direct course to have a trade war with America. France is doing a similar thing. America is not going to be happy. So, yay, global trade war.
Hooray. And Google is finally in talks with publishers about paying a licensing fee for content in a news product. So basically all we know about this is that negotiations have begun. You suspect that they've actually been thinking about when they're going to implement this for quite some time, considering the pressure on them. But interesting to know that now the process is underway.
I just really, really, really hope for this they don't do what Facebook did, which is I will pay these 20 publishers millions of dollars and everybody else can just, you know, suck it up. I think the key thing from what I've seen here is that this is for they're looking to do a specific news product, not that publishers are suddenly going to get paid for like snippets or anything like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Also depends. They've got to put, and they will, but they've got to put real budget behind it so that they can pay loads of people. And the W.H. Smith Daily Telegraph saga has been resolved. Everyone will be happy to know. If you want to find your copy of the Telegraph, it's back with the rest of the newspapers away from the magazines.
So is this a print newspaper?
Yeah, it is. Do you know?
Where do you get those?
Well, I mean, it's certainly in print. I don't know about the second part of that label.
Uh-huh.
But there's a...
Well, so how did they resolve it, that W.H. Smith actually accepted it was a newspaper?
No, it wasn't that. There is some financial incentive for them to put it back on there. This was always a sort of like...
Good old W.H. Smith.
It was, for a couple of days, it was fun to say that the Telegraph was not on a newsstand, you know, that it was part of the magazine section.
It was on
section.
The comics.
Yeah, exactly. But despite that, there's a really interesting... Twitter thread that we're going to link to in the newsletter that suggests that, you know, as a result of a lot of changes that have taken place at the Telegraph, a bunch of cuts, you know, the removal from the ABCs, it's possible that they're trying to position it for a sale.
Oh, we knew that, right?
Yeah, I know, but like they're trying to obfuscate some of the realities of it in preparation for the scale.
Oh, that's a big one.
That's a big word for 8:30 a.m. And Times Radio has apparently been not so quietly poaching BBC talent.
Yeah,
John Pina.
Yeah. Yeah. That one I think is particularly fun because his show is called Pina's Politics. Oof. So like he is indivisible from the brand. So what the hell are they going to do with that?
I've just looked across and the cat is just so bored.
So this week I spoke to Paul Newman, who is the Brand Director of Home Interest at Future PLC. So I began by asking him what his role as Brand Director actually involves.
So I'm the Brand Director of Future's Home Interest division, and my role as Brand Director is essentially to set the strategy for the business, to make sure that strategy is delivered, and perhaps most importantly of all, to generate growth across all of the brands that make up the Future Home Interest Group, which include home building and renovating, Real Homes, and Period Living. Those are our kind of three key brands.
So it's sort of almost like a bit of a publisher role. You've got a bit of a commercial element in there as well.
Absolutely. So I'm sure in today's day and age, we call people like me all kinds of different things at different organisations. But I think publishing director is probably a good way to look at it, if that's helpful for people.
And Future's Home Interest Group, it's a pretty new acquisition for the business, which I think you're involved in. Can you outline your role in bringing that into the business and kind of how that interest group has actually been established within Future?
Of course, happy to. So just a bit of background, I think would probably be helpful to start with. So Future acquired the home interest part of Centaur's business back in late 2017. And once the initial integration was completed, I came on board in 2018 to help develop the brands. And it's a great business unit, actually, with strength in events, magazines, and online. So nicely diversified and a really good base to work with.
What will success look like for the division, you know, if we're looking sort of 5 years down the line?
Oh, that's a great question. So, I mean, there are a number of ways that you can define success. I mean, you can look at audience growth, for example, are we reaching more people? You can look at revenue and profit growth. So are we making more money and returning our shareholders' investment to them? You can look at the success of culturally integrating a new business and its people. And I'd like to think that, you know, we've achieved all of those things so far. But I think most importantly of all, we have to ask, did we satisfy our audience in doing those things? And at Future, we set out to connect people with their passions everywhere. That's a really important mantra for us. And if we do that successfully, we believe that we will make money in doing so. So in terms of how that kind of pans out over that five-year period, which you referenced, I think success for me would be a really stable set of brands that are growing and continuing to kind of reach and surprise and delight people in new and innovative ways each year, I guess.
I like that idea of surprising and delighting. It's not a word we use that often enough.
No, I think that's right. It's probably something that comes from that kind of magazine background, that magazine kind of heritage that's kind of in my DNA, really. But I think it's really important that the products that we create and the way that we create them retain the ability to give people, you know, kind of unintended kind of discovery pleasure, or however you want to describe it, something that kind of raises a smile in the mind or kind of makes them feel, yeah, that was £4.99 really well spent on a magazine, or I'm really glad I clicked on that article or came to that event.
Well, that leads beautifully into my next question, which is you've actually managed to increase circulation on, I believe it's the print titles of Period Living and Real Homes, which is quite an achievement in today's market. Can you give away, you know, can you give away all your secrets about how that's worked?
Well, I certainly can't give away all those secrets, but you're absolutely right. It's a very challenging environment today in print magazine publishing. So we're, you know, very fortunate that we managed to achieve that success. I think probably I should kind of start by pointing out that, you know, Future culturally is all about the team rather than the individual. So many people have contributed to that success. But in terms of how we got there, what we did was look at the strength of the business that we'd acquired. And that strength was the multi-channel setup that it had. And therefore, right, you know, that kind of presents what I would call a diversification of opportunity, if you like. So what we did was we start by building a holistic business plan where events, print and digital can support each other. So in terms of how that looks in kind of a tangible sense, we use our home building and renovating events as a shop for our magazines. So we have 8 events around the country each year. Our magazines can provide content for our websites. So we have a lot of content sharing between our print and digital expressions of the brands. And our websites can promote our events and magazines too. So helping deliver new audience to them. So I think once you kind of take that kind of core premise, specifically in terms of magazine publishing, we kind of looked at Period Living and Real Homes, and we saw some real opportunities there actually. Both titles have really great USPs that we can build on. So we looked at how we could put the best value package out each month onto the newsstand. And that involves being competitive in terms of the product offering. So, the quantity of content that you produce and cover amounts that might go with that kind of core proposition. The pricing that you offer, making sure that we're competitive in terms of pricing. And then we kind of built out further from there really by experimenting with what we call event issues on the newsstand. And these are special editions of the magazine where we include extra gifts and we raise the cover price of the magazine to kind of accommodate those extra costs. So Period Living is a really good example of that. We had a Waitrose exclusive last summer where we partnered with the homeware designer Sophie Allport, and we gave away a shopper bag with the magazine. We put the price of the magazine up to £7.99 that issue. That was an element of risk to doing that. But it was hugely successful. It was more successful than any other issue we published in Waitrose that year. And it showed us that actually if we create a great product, then the market is there. People will buy it, even in today's world where print is under so much pressure.
And at a practical level, actually, in the office, do you have separate teams for print, events, digital, or do the team kind of share skills and are they quite integrated with each other?
Yeah, that's a really good question. It's a bit of both, is the truth of that. So we have some people who are specialists and will be focused primarily online, and some people who will be focused primarily on print. However, what we've done is we've created a culture where both of those teams work together. So all of the content that we create for our magazines is written directly into our CMS on our websites, which means that we can therefore reuse almost everything that we produce via the magazine in addition to the content that the digital teams make. So we're definitely working in a channel agnostic way. Events is slightly different. Our events are very specialist and kind of focused on kind of building projects in the kind of self-build and renovation space. So there's not quite as much synergy in terms of the content that the events need in the way that the websites need that content. However, we do have members of those teams contributing to the events in some way, whether it's kind of manning our Ask the Expert stands at a home building and renovating show, or whether it's delivering seminars on how to start a self-build project. So we're very interconnected, and I think that's the real strength behind what we do.
I'm just quite curious about the audience for these titles, because people who own homes tend to be a little older, certainly these days. Is there anything you're doing to kind of reach a younger, aspirational audience who might not own their own homes, or is that not really where the market is? Are you more interested in people who are actually willing to spend money on their houses?
Yeah, it's a really perceptive question, actually. It is incredibly difficult to target a younger magazine buying demographic. as I'm sure many of your guests have kind of probably explained previously. So there's no doubt that the audience is getting older, and the point you make about home ownership is almost certainly supporting that. So people are getting on the housing ladder later, they are acquiring wealth via property later in life than was traditionally the case. And I have no doubt that that aligns with the purchasing patterns that we see in terms of consumer magazines. What's great about having a diversified business, of course, is that you can reach that younger audience that might not be ready to commit to buying a magazine today, but still wants to consume the content because they want to aspire to owning a home or doing a renovation project once they manage to get out of the, you know, the house share that they're in, or you know, when they're no longer a student. And therefore, we have, you know, brands like realhomes.com and all of the social media channels that go with that, which enable us to reach a much broader demographic.
And you've actually got a video series recently, haven't you, the Real Homes Online. Can you talk a bit about that and why you chose to run it?
Yeah, happy to. So, again, I think this all goes back to having a really diversified product strategy at the core of your business. And one of the things that we identified after we'd acquired the business from Centaur was that the one area where perhaps they hadn't developed it as much as they could have done was in video. So we saw a clear gap where we could apply Future's expertise to helping to develop that. And the Real Home Show, which for those of your listeners who aren't familiar with it, is a fortnightly online TV product, which you can view by YouTube or via realhomes.com, has been a huge success since we launched it last April. We've generated hundreds of thousands of views of the show. It's proved incredibly popular with commercial partners. And we're now on series four and approaching our first anniversary. So the video side of it, I think, is really important and something where I think we can develop a lot further.
A pivot to video that's been a success, that's a rare feat.
Well, I mean, it's disappointing if that's the case. I mean, I'd like to think that certainly in future, we proved, you know, very adept at being able to find a way to turn video into a credible business model. I think the important thing is just to start with a good, solid business plan and to understand why you're creating video rather than just creating video because you think you should or because somebody in senior management thinks, oh, we haven't got any video content, maybe we should get on with creating some.
Yeah, well, I suppose you've got the advantage as well that it's so visual, like what everything the magazine is about is visual, so it helps to have a different way of engaging with people that way.
Yeah, I think that's right, and that's definitely played to our advantage in terms of the print magazine too. So if you think about the people that you know, who and you might be one of them, who buy magazines about homes, they tend to leave them on their coffee tables, or they tend to display them on their kitchen worktops.
Yes, it's a status symbol.
Exactly. And you'll visit some people who have literally every magazine that's published every month from every publisher, and some people who have every edition of a certain magazine that they really aspire to. So certainly that visual medium really plays to our strengths and helps to give us some protection to the business.
And the other thing a number of publishers have gone into quite recently is sort of e-commerce, affiliate revenue, and that sort of thing. Has that changed how Future's Home Interest brands are doing things, or does that not really apply to you?
Oh, it's absolutely huge for us in terms of e-commerce. I wouldn't say that it impacted print so much for us, but it's certainly been a huge element of the digital development of the brands. So I guess for the benefit of listeners, we should probably explain the e-commerce happens on a Future website in the form of a price comparison tool. And that tool appears alongside buying guides and reviews. So essentially the reader might go onto Google and search for something like best vacuum cleaner. And they'll then discover our article that kind of explains which is the best and compares the products in the market. They select the product that's right for them, and then they see the price comparison widget underneath. If they then click through to the retailer and make a purchase, we take a cut of the revenue.
Okay, that's really interesting. Is that just for kind of the smaller, you know, vacuum cleaners, sideboards, that sort of thing? Or, you know, could you buy a staircase or a home renovation project?
I think it'd be difficult to buy a home renovation project online. But there are...
We can dream.
But there are ways of kind of approaching that. That would probably be more of a kind of a lead generation play than perhaps an affiliate e-commerce play. But absolutely, any product that you can buy online that there is a price comparison available for, we can effectively cover as long as it's relevant to our audience. But you know what the really funny thing is about all of this is that once you remove the price comparison widget, it really illustrates how little the media and readers have changed in the digital era. So magazines were solving the question of which one should I buy long before websites came along.
Yeah.
Just now that we can go an extra step and help them find the best price too.
Do you think that price comparison widget makes a big difference to conversions?
I don't think it makes a difference in terms of the audience that we generate from search. So if people don't want to buy, and they're simply doing their initial phase of research, or they don't want to take advantage of the price comparison, they then want to go and buy a product on the high street, they can still do that. They can still get all the information they need from our article. If they do want to buy, then obviously that makes a big difference to our business model.
You've been at Future for quite a while, and it's one of those businesses that from the outside, it seems to be a really very, very different business from what it was a decade ago. What do you think some of the reasons for that are?
So that's a good question, which could have a very long answer that might send people to sleep. So I'll try and be really concise. I think what Future has done is it's been on that kind of continuum from being a magazine-centric publisher to becoming a much more diversified media business where digital products and exhibitions and other revenue streams have come in and have helped to kind of evolve the direction in which we're heading. And what I guess we ideally want is we'd like strength in all of our key areas like home interest and technology and photography and so on. We'd like to have strength across all of the different media platforms and channels that people are passionate about and have as diverse a business as we can. Because that way we can really serve exactly what people want in the way that they want it and when they want it. And I think therefore, the really big change for me has been, and probably particularly in the last 5 years, really kind of discovering what our role is in the media landscape in today's kind of multi-channel era. And I think that's probably the big difference, because 10 years ago, we were still really trying to kind of figure out how we would become a digital publisher and how we would evolve our business in that way. Today, I think we've got a much more holistic approach and a much greater understanding of how and why we need to reach an audience.
And is that a case that what works for maybe technology, you can kind of take in a cookie cutter way and apply to home interest? Or are there quite a lot of differences and it's just a case of getting the right skills in place?
I think yes and no is the answer to that. I think there are definitely things that, where we can kind of, cross-pollinate and we can learn things from what other verticals are doing. It would be great if everything was as simple as kind of copying and pasting and kind of changing the words from gadgets to homes or whatever it might be. But the truth is that you have to be really understanding of why the different audiences behave in the ways that they do, how the demographic is different, what those needs are. And then you can take an underlying platform, which might be a technology platform that works across a number of different websites, or it could be a model for creating magazines. And then you can layer it up with the things that are specific and tailored to those individuals.
And the other thing I was curious about, home interest is an area, it's, I look at myself and my peers and we've all got our Pinterest boards about our dream homes. And brands, you've got a lot of brands that are increasingly moving into that area and trying to kind of capture that market. So what are you doing to kind of make the print and digital side of your brands relevant, maybe not necessarily in competition with Pinterest, but alongside things like that?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think the start point for us has to be to understand what each channel can do for us as a brand and as a business. So we have a very active presence on Pinterest, which you mentioned, on Real Homes. It's a great source of referral traffic for our website.
So you're there already.
So we're there already. I think we could probably always do more. But it's a great converter for us in terms of audience. And I think what we have to do is we have to ensure that when we create print products that we understand what the drivers are for people going to Pinterest. And I think what we talked about earlier in terms of how people like to display Holmes magazines on their coffee tables with pride. There's another reason why they buy them in the first place, and it's that fantastic kind of canvas that you get when you open up a magazine and you get effectively two sheets of A4 next to each other with a beautiful picture that's kind of full bleed. And the inspirational quality of that, I think, is very powerful. So you can obviously engage with that content all day long on probably a smartphone and absorb that content. But it really comes to life and goes to the next level when you see it in print, I think. So we need to be conscious of how those channels are kind of informing the behavior of our audience. But we also need to make sure that we kind of also stick to the kind of the core principles that make things like print what they are.
Yes, I suppose they're not in competition. They've just got different aspects to how you'd use them.
That's right. Yeah, I think many people down the years have talked about, wouldn't it be great if we could convert all of our digital and social users into print magazine buyers? I've yet to find the magic formula for doing that, but we certainly use Pinterest and Instagram very intensively, and Facebook and Twitter to promote magazine subscriptions. And in fact, going back to one of your earlier questions about how we'd manage to grow the circulation on Period Living and Real Homes. One of the reasons for that is that everybody in the content team, whether they are working on a print title or a digital product, takes responsibility for helping to promote the magazines and sell subscriptions. So we are very active on our social media channels in terms of explaining that there are magazine versions of the digital brand that you're engaging with, and ensuring that we serve people competitive and regular offers as well. And that's been a huge driver to that circulation growth for us.
And then the last question we ask all our guests is, what's the last thing you read or saw or watched that really affected you?
Oh, okay, that's a bit of a poser. it's a bit of a strange one, actually, because I'm not a football fan and I don't listen to Desert Island Discs, but I did find the recent episode with Ian Wright, the former footballer and TV pundit, incredibly moving. He really opened up about his childhood and was in floods of tears two or three times during the broadcast. And I just found the honesty and humanity of it really touching. And they say that radio is the medium of disclosure. And I think that really enforced that feeling for me. And I just really can't imagine it being as emotive in any other format. Of course, I hope people are also moved to tears by listening to us talking about Future's Home Interest Portfolio. But I suspect it won't be quite that impact.
Yeah, no, I don't think we don't aim to provoke quite that reaction. And we couldn't go an episode without mentioning the Publisher Podcast Awards. Tickets are now off sale, so if you haven't bought them, it's too late.
Yeah, this is just rubbing it in people's faces, though, isn't it?
Well, we have warned you, or you're going to sneak people in under your coat.
Yeah, Peter's suddenly like 12 foot tall in a massive trench coat.
So if you've bought a ticket, we will see you there, and we're really, really quite excited about it.
If you're desperate for more sartorial news from the Media Voices team, you can go to voices.media, which contains all our previous episodes, links out to things we've been writing, and much more besides. It also includes a link where you can subscribe to our weekly newsletter, which goes out every Wednesday.
And if you want to follow more regularly than that, and who wouldn't, get yourself on Twitter at Media Voices Pod. There's stuff going out every day, but not from me, because I'm going on holiday.
So until next week, when we're going to be back with another fantastic interview and a great guest host, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.